In 6 days, your brother will turn. Will you open the door? The Time We Have is now live on BackerKit, a tragic two-player zombie TTRPG played on opposite sides of a closed door. Inspired by games like For the Queen, this game is contained in an 80-card tarot-sized deck that you can grab right now on our BackerKit campaign. The Time We Have is written and designed by Elliot Davis, with illustrations by Ripley Ash, editing by Samantha Lee, and the theme song you're hearing by Behold. So please head to sadzombiegame.com or search The Time We Have on BackerKit and help us make this game a reality. Thank you. Hey, Brian.
Hey, Elliot.
What's the talk of the table?
Today, we're talking... Elliot, you didn't fill in the guest.
No, read on.
Today we're... Are you serious?
Just read it.
Today, we're... I'm talking with... Elliot Davis, also known as More Blueberries, preeminent game designer, actual play virtuoso, and world-renowned...
Just say it.
No! Designer of games like Something Is Wrong With the Chickens, Project Echo, and Rom-Com Drama Bomb, and he's here today to talk about... Elliot, you didn't even fill this in. What do you want to talk about?
The Time We Have.
Yeah, we have time, so just like pick what you want to talk about, and then we'll do this whole charade.
The game is called The Time We Have.
We're here to talk about his new game, The Time We Have. Elliot Davis, you're here.
Hello, it's me.
Was that as much fun for you guys as it was for us?
It was very fun for us. Hi, Brian.
How's it going, Elliot?
It's good. Fun to be in the guest seat.
So we are here to talk about your latest game, The Time We Have. And, you know, just to set this up right, we always like to talk about what our goal is for the episode, for the conversation. I think what I'd love to talk to you about specifically in terms of this game is I've kind of like been with you through a lot of your game design journey from like we met right when you were putting out Something Is Wrong With the Chickens, then Project Echo, Rom-Com Drama Bomb, 1,000 Zips, and now The Time We Have. And I'd love to talk about what lessons you've learned over the course of making those games and crowdfunding those games, and what of those lessons you've brought into making The Time We Have. So to start us off, what is The Time We Have?
Yeah, so The Time We Have is a two-player tragic zombie duet TTRPG played on opposite sides of a closed door. It is a game in which two players play brothers in a zombie apocalypse after one of them has been infected and the final days before that brother turns. It's a conversational game. It's immersive in that you're sitting on opposite sides of a closed door, and ultimately you tell this tragic story of the final days before you say goodbye.
I love that the very first time that we hung out in a coffee shop that I used to spend a lot more time in than I do these days.
I know you've lost touch with Cafe Reggio a bit.
I have. I have a really big monitor now, and I've gotten a little too used to it in a way that I'm not proud of.
Which just shows you, folks, Brian edited without a monitor even when he was home for a long time.
Yeah. I also still edit only with a trackpad.
Oh, God.
Like a crazy person.
It's horrible.
I'm not advertising. I'm not saying you should do this. I'm saying this is my sickness to bear. But what's interesting is the first time we met, you told me about your idea for Project Echo and also about your idea for a like two-player zombie game that I think at the time might have been epistolary. It might have been like a letter-writing thing.
Yeah, it was, back when we first talked, it was like a three-line note in my notes app where I was like, what if it was there were some thoughts about whether maybe this is a solo game, maybe it's a solo game about processing another person going through a zombie transformation. And then it was like, what if it is just like you're passing a journal back and forth? I was very inspired by games like Tether at the time by Adam Bofoni. And the game idea kind of just sat like that for a while. It was just like, It was going to be shared journal. It was going to be like very sort of slow and meditative versus I think what it is now, which is more real time to play kind of is more of the vibe now. And then eventually the idea came of splitting a deck of cards. Like when the deck of cards became the mechanic, that's when the first real seeds of what this game would ultimately become emerged, which was let's split the deck in half, spades and clubs and hearts and diamonds, and some of these will be passed and some of these will trigger prompts. And that was kind of the initial seed of what ultimately would become the game.
So once you had the idea of the deck of cards, that's when it was like off to the races. That's the point when it's like, oh, this game's getting made.
Sort of. I mean, it was like that. Even still, I think that that development is about a year and a half to 2 years old, potentially, where it was like, okay, that's the mechanic. But I still put this game off for a long time relative to other ideas, relative to Project Echo, when I cracked that mechanic. And Rom-Com Drama Bomb was obviously this sort of weird thing that popped up in the middle of a bunch of other ideas I had. And the off to the races moment finally came for this game when I decided that it was about brothers and it wasn't just about any two people in a zombie apocalypse. That was like, I think that I wasn't feeling as inspired to make it or like that like need to make it, which I think often comes with certain games. Like when I finally actually am willing to push and do all the things is like when I hit that like need to make moment. And that didn't happen until I was like, I think it was about a year ago, I talked to Patrick from The Soloist, and he had asked, like, what games do you have on the horizon? And I was like, I want to make a sad game about brothers in the zombie apocalypse. And that was kind of the hint I gave him. And kind of in saying that and thinking about that question, that was what was like, oh, okay, now I'm really excited about this game. And kind of as soon as Rom-Com was over, it really started to feel like something I had to do.
You and I, on this podcast and off, have been talking a lot more about specificity in gaming.
Yeah,
I think some of that came from, you know, Yzeba's Bed and Breakfast, having like pre-made characters. I think we started to see it in Rom-Com Drama Bomb, because that's a very specific experience. This game is incredibly specific in that it is brothers. You are playing as brothers. Like the game kind of dictates that.
Yeah.
Why brothers specifically? Like why was that the thing that interested you? And kind of to build on that further, why do you think specificity makes this game stronger?
In general, I think specificity, the more I play and the more I read and get interested in games, is I think that, like, it's just become my taste, is that I get way more excited when a game is specific, way more excited when a game puts guardrails around me that I have to play within. We, you know, obviously we've talked to Jay Dragon a lot, and that's a huge facet of Jay's design, and I think like even all the way back to 10 Candles, which was one of the first games we played together, like 10 Candles sure. is not like you can set 10 Candles in a lot of worlds, but it is a really specific experience. It's like the scenes are very set and like you're going to die at the end. And ultimately Brothers was me asking myself the question, okay, I have this thought of like processing somebody turning into a zombie. What would be the single most devastating relationship for me to go through that with? And I am one of five siblings, including step-siblings and a bunch of fun blended family nonsense. But I grew up with two older brothers. And so I've always had my two brothers and I have very different relationships with the two of them, both close, but in very different ways and, you know, ups and downs over the years. And it's just like, I just thought about it. And the more and more I thought about it, I thought about how rich of a relationship it is to explore. And, you know, there's obviously, you see that in movies a lot. I mean, I feel like, I'm trying to think of an example now, but like, there's like, what's the fighting movie that came out in the last 10 years?
Warrior.
Yeah.
I watch that movie once every 6 months. I don't advertise it as being like the best movie of all time, but man, it hits so hard.
Because brothers are messy. They can be really messy. And it's just like, man,
I cry in that last fighting scene every time. Every single time. The song that plays during that came on like a Spotify mix one time. I was like, I got
it. You felt it rise.
I can't do it.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like, if there's one thing that will always get me in a movie or a TV show or something, it's like when you've got like a complicated brotherly relationship. And so it was like, ultimately, it was why brothers for me, it's the sort of one of the most meaningful relationships in my life and the one that I feel like I can write about with nuance and kind of welcome people into through play. And then I was talking to our friend M. Friedman about this when we saw her a few weeks ago, and she sort of asked me the question of like, why brothers, like, rather than giving people the option? And I think that the big, like, game design answer there is I don't want people to character create out of the vulnerability and the sort of heaviness of it. You know, like, if I just said you can play any two people, you might say we're just survivors who met and we formed a very tenuous relationship. And that's a way different game. You know, like, right. Brothers, no matter you have a good relationship, a bad relationship, there's history and there's tension, like, just built in, and you can't kind of squirrel your way out from under it.
We recently got to play with Jay Dragon, Jay's new game, The Seven Part Pact, and that game really does not let you escape anything. Like, you have, it forces you to be in uncomfortable situations in a very fun way. And I've realized playing that game how much I, despite as a game master sometimes like pushing people to like into uncomfortable and difficult situations, when I'm playing a game, I try to avoid those at all costs.
Yeah.
And the
second
a game forces me into them, I'm like, oh, this is better. I 100% would not have gotten here on my own.
Yeah.
I 100% needed someone designing the maze for me so that I get to the more emotionally intense or the more like narratively intense moment, because I wouldn't have gotten there on my own.
100%.
How in this game, because, you know, not everyone has the experience of having a close relationship with brothers or having brothers at all, how do you kind of set up that relationship for people who may not be familiar with what that feels like?
It's interesting because I think that it's like, it is a, I don't think it took as much work as I thought it would to have to put people into that headspace based on the people I've now watched play it. First of all, it just tells you right away. That's like, that's the thing. Like from I think rules card 3, you are told you are brothers. And so immediately you're put into that headspace of like, okay, I have to think about what my relationship is to this other person. But ultimately it comes down to the prompts in the game are this mix of the kinds of conversations that I think come up when you're a brother. There is humor in the prompts. You know, in a very sad game, there is like the sort of gallows humor of like what brothers can sometimes have. Like, I think about some of the conversations when my family's been going through some of their hardest times in my life, and me and my brother sitting and making jokes about it, like, honestly. And that feels very specific. And then there are a lot of direct questions about, like, our past, our family members, our things we haven't apologized for, all things that are very, like, getting one of those tells you a lot about this relationship. And it's a relationship that you could apply to something. It's a question you could apply to something else, but some of them, I think in concert, all of them feel very specific to brothers. It's like the mix of prompts is very specific to brothers.
I do think that the way that people break tension is often the best way to define a relationship.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, 100%.
When you have a really strong relationship and you see the, you know, the way, I'm trying to think of a good example, but like, you know, there's tension around the family table and one person just like lifts up their butt cheek and farts and that relieves the tension. You know what I mean? It's like that tells much about what that family is.
Yeah, it is actually hard to not put a fart joke in the game because that is such a thing with my family in particular. But I
You're on opposite sides of the door, so it's like perfect. Your butts are so close to each other.
It's perfect. It's perfect. I've had the chance now to play this 4 times, and I think that a great example of this sort of how people break tension tells you a lot about their relationship. If you look at the game I played with Chinook, which will be out at the time that this is out, and then if you then go listen to the game I played with Jeff Stormer, which will be out in a few days after this comes out, in Jeff and I's game, Jeff had made the choice to create that we have many siblings. Like, we are 2 of 5 brothers. And so the way that the two of us broke tension was deflecting to these other siblings. We were never willing to really get into it with each other, but we would use talking about these other siblings to be like, oh, well, if Glenn was here, this is how he'd be acting. And that's like a very classic way to deflect. Whereas Chinook and I played kind of like really strained brothers, like a really strained relationship. And we always went to fuck you.
Like, you know, like we always just would, like, when we didn't know how else to break the tension, it was like, fuck you, I'm mad at you for this other thing. So, yeah, you're right. That is a great way to put it.
Because you're doing this game not as just a book, but as a, like, tarot-sized deck of cards, like For the Queen and other Descended for the Queen games, I'm curious how that game, which is, we've kind of talked about as, like, a bit of an Ur game, a bit of, like, a game designer's game, how did that game influence this design? And more specifically, how did your approach differ from For the Queen in setting up a game?
Yeah, it's interesting because I've been thinking a lot about, like, whether it feels right to put the Descended from the Queen sort of tag on the game. And I don't think it does, but I definitely will be, you know, crediting the inspiration of For the Queen in the credits of the game, because it is, there is a lot of it that I've taken from it. For the Queen does, like, rules-based prompt cards so well. Like you and I got to play that game for the first time together, and as soon as we started doing the, like, round robin of reading through those cards, I was like, oh, this is just the easiest way to get into a game. There's nothing easier. And so I took a lot of inspiration for the rules cards. Also, For the Queen has the ending card, which is the queen is under attack. Do you protect her? And similarly, this game has an ending card, which is do you open the door? And so in terms of, like, pacing and ending the game, there's a lot of inspiration in that you place this card randomly, similar to For the Queen. One of the biggest things it does differently is it brings in this physical space of the door, which honestly is still inspired a bit by Alex Roberts, because we had a conversation with Alex Roberts over the summer about LARPs, and I'd been, you know, reading LARPs from Banana Chan, and just kind of that was a world I was discovering just a little bit more about. And I think that I've had people who play say this is a very LARPy choice to have people play on opposite sides of a closed door. And so that is a big difference. It is only two players is another big difference. And then where For the Queen has all prompt cards, I introduced a few different kinds of cards to this game. So there are prompt cards that are that will feel very familiar to someone who's played For the Queen, where it is a question. There are also perception cards, which are passed silently under the door and then reacted to. And so these will be things like, you smell blood, or you hear me pace, or you hear me laughing to myself. And then the third kind of card is the infection card. And these are cards that only the infected brother has. And these signal two things. They signal the end of a fictional day in the game. The infection takes 6 days or less. Each of these is the end of one of those days. And it also is a role play changer for the infected brother. It will tell you things like wait 10 seconds to respond, respond in only one sentence, take the next question that your brother asks the wrong way. So these are fun ways to sort of push people into specific kinds of role play as the infection gets worse and worse. So a lot of stuff from For the Queen, a lot of sort of my own stuff in, but ultimately I was really just, I think just card powered games are cool as hell. We also got the chance to play Fedora Noir earlier this year, and that was the delight.
Yeah. I really love the idea of the perception cards in particular, of, like, passing those under, and it feels almost like a GM just, like, narrating two things that happen, especially because if you're sitting on opposite sides of the door, you're not looking at each other. Like, you're kind of in your own world a little bit, and then you get that little glimpse into someone else's world.
Yeah.
It's just very fun.
It really hurts when you get past something like you smell blood and then you have to react to that silent, like off a silent passing.
I also like that is so much more intense. Getting a silent cue is so much more intense than me saying, like, you smell blood. Because also, like, as a player, especially if you haven't done one of these types of games before, or if you're not really into performing in this type of way, that might not hit. Like, it might just be hard to say, or, like, hard to communicate. Whereas passing a card under the door, everyone knows, like, you know, the scene in the movie when someone slides a folded piece of paper across the table. Like, there's tension in the slide and there's tension in the open. And now you just get to really experience that moment.
You're so right, because it's a kind of thing that a certain kind of player might do automatically. A certain kind of player might build the world around them, but it takes that work away from people. It's like, yes, you are having a conversation, but there are also just, like, things happening. There are experiences, there are sounds, there are sights. Like, one of the cards, the perception cards, is you hear a commotion outside. We have to stay quiet while you go investigate. And every time that card has come up in play, it is a like very tense moment of like, as soon as the other brother who you've passed it to reads it, they have to be like, hey, shut the fuck up. I have to go. And then there's a great tension of waiting until they've decided that they're back from investigating. And that could have been a question card. You know, in a different world, that could have been like, you left to investigate. What did you find? But it feels a lot more immersive when it is like stated kind of as fact.
Yeah. I don't think it would be nearly as powerful if it was a question. Because then it's, you're already removed from it. Whereas if you hear a thing, I have to deal with it now. I can't just be reacting to what it was.
Yeah. Oh, that actually reminds me of another key difference kind of between this game and For the Queen. And this was something that in an early playtest with Viditya Valetti I worked out, was that the questions in For the Queen ask you, the player, to answer them, whereas the questions in The Time We Have are you speaking as your character asking the other player.
Oh, interesting.
And what that kind of helps do is it helps people get into in-character roleplay, I think, if that's a thing that they're sort of less comfortable with. But it also just creates that feeling of, like, trying to bridge the gap across this door. Which, like, I'll tell you, like, playing on the opposite side of a door is not a super comfortable experience. Like, it's like the sound is hard. You got to kind of lean towards the crack. And so it does kind of mean that every card you're having to bridge that gap. Whereas, like, if it was just asking you a question, then you'd be having this isolated experience on your half of the door, and the other person could chime in, but now, like, they have to.
I keep thinking about playing this game and being, like, the infected person and being, like, late in the game and going to slide a card under the door and then having the other person grab it and me pull it back. Just, like, having one of those moments.
That's really spooky.
No, I'm really excited about this game. Actually, a good thing to talk about with this game, because as you said, you know, you're playing on opposite sides of the door. It is kind of it could be physically uncomfortable. You're likely sitting on the ground. It's tough to hear. But there's also, like, this is a very heavy emotional topic. This is two brothers, so a familiar relationship. One of you is going to die and you're playing through it. How do you guide players through an inherently intense experience? And what kind of safety tools are you recommending for this game?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's you know, one aspect of this is giving some content warnings in the rules that tell you, like, here are directions this is very likely to go, and take care and make sure that you talk about it beforehand. The safety tool in this game, because you can't see each other, you can't use an X card kind of in the same way, was what I realized in early design, is that you can't have that visual X on the table that you can both see and both tap. And so the safety tool that I've made for this game, heavily inspired by the X card and things like script change, is the knock card. It's a three knock system. Each player has one of these knock cards in front of them that you keep visible the entire time. And one knock is very X card like. You skip a topic, you end kind of where we're at, like, hey, like, we're getting too in detail, let's just, like, move on. Two knocks is let's pull out of character and talk about what just happened and maybe remove something from play if we need to, resuming play with two more knocks. And then three knocks is the ripcord. Three knocks is we open the door, the game's over, maybe we start playing again, maybe we don't, but that is like a full ripcord. It's a way of using safety tools that also play with this play environment. You know, it's like, it's a way that is like, it is very easy to get, and it's very easy to use. And I think that, you know, there's a lot of things with safety tools that sometimes people can forget they're there. But I do think that something like knocking on the door feels very natural in this moment, and I do hope that it helps people. The other thing that the safety tool says is it tells you when you're done playing to open the door and hug the other player right away. That is, like, in the rules on the safety card, is that you need to open the door and make that physical contact and debrief the session that you just had, because it's just, like, it's important to remind yourself that, like, the other person is not going to die, and, like, you're not in a zombie apocalypse. Like, especially when you're in such an immersive experience, I think that, like, making that physical contact in every time that I've played, obviously some of them have been remote, so you can't quite do that, but that sort of turn the camera on and look at each other. But making that physical contact has been such a, like, decompression of the adrenaline in my body of, like, what usually has gotten really tense at the end. And then a debrief conversation is always, always super important, I think, for this game. Because, you know, I've had some people who've played who have said that, like, very intense relatable things to their own life experience have come up, and they've wanted to talk it out with their friends. And so, yeah, that's kind of the full suite of safety. But ultimately, you know, you put what you can out there, and I hope people take care and heed the content warnings.
Right. I do like that in your discussion of safety tools, there is a pre-game safety tool, a peri-game safety tool, a during-game safety tool, and a post-game safety tool. And I never really considered that as a thing. And I guess a lot of games kind of accidentally have that, but I like that it's very intentional here of the pre-game safety tool is here are the content warnings. Also, this is the experience you're going to get. If you're not into that experience, don't play this game. Middle of the game is here's a way to communicate to each other while you're playing. And then post-game is let's make sure that that was okay and like leave this space together, you know, in a positive way.
Yeah, 100%. Because, you know, sometimes you don't even know that something has fucked you up until you're out of play.
A Fool's Errand is a tarot-fueled science fantasy game set in a post-calamity world of androids, humans, and all those in between. Build your fools and explore realms both waking and subconscious. But the more powerful you get, the more the major arcana gods will take notice and rain down their love and rage as both boons and calamities. Every calamity dreams its successor. The world approaches its next big oops. So, fool, will you deny these jealous gods? Back A Fool's Errand right now by visiting www.afoolserrandgame.com. Your errand awaits.
Hey there, it's Elliot from the Many Sided Media team. In addition to playing and producing here on My First Dungeon, I'm also a game designer, known for such games as Something Is Wrong With The Chickens, a rules-like game of chickens, eldritch horror, and revenge. Project Echo, a solo time travel game played in the pages of a planner. And the upcoming Rom-Com Drama Bomb, a three-player game of meet cutes and mayhem. If you like weird and unique games and want to bring something new to your table, head to moreblueberries.shop and use code MYFIRSTDUNGEON for 20% off your order. That's MOREBLUEBERRIES.shop. Thanks!
So before we move on into the crowdfunding effort for this game, I do kind of want to talk just very broadly about what you have learned from the first games that you made all the way up until now. And what are the big lessons that you've gotten from Project Echo, from Rom-Com Drama Bomb, from Something Is Wrong With Chickens, from 1,000 Zips, as a game designer that you found have been the most important ones in the time we have?
Yeah, I mean, it's been a lot. There's an element of this that is like, I have learned a lot as a publisher, as an independent, you know, publisher of my own games, as a self-publishing artist. I think with each of my games, I've developed a lot more confidence in spending money on production, you know, in like putting money into what makes like, and working with these numbers about like, okay, if we spend this much on books, they will sell for this much and we can, you know, and we can make a profit and things like that. I think that all started with Abominations, which was the first print I made, which all Abominations did for me, and like, I love Abominations. I think it's a very fun game. I think it's a board game, not an RPG, but like, it's a very fun game. What that did for me was like, I can make something physical, and I put it in 20-sided store. It's like, I can make something physical and I can sell it to a store. And then I made Something Is Wrong With The Chickens, and I did that independent of something like a zine month or a crowdfunding. I just made it. And I was like, okay, I have the ability to do this and bring something into life. And Something Is Wrong With The Chickens is how I developed a relationship with Indie Press Revolution. It was the first time I dealt with like printing lots and lots of copies of something and distributing them out. And then when it came to Project Echo, it was a really big leap forward for me of like, okay, now how do I make a book and how do I make a planner, and how do I like make something like physically nice that people want to put on their shelf? And part of that was, hey, what am I not good enough at to do myself anymore? And I hired you to do layout for that book. And that was a huge, huge help for making Project Echo happen. Like, could I have mustered my way through it? Yeah, but it wouldn't have looked as good. And then I think by the time we get to Rom-Com Drama Bomb, it's like, I have a real clear thought of like, I know what I want this book to look like, and I'm going to make it look like that. And now I know all the things about like color and layout and the artist I want to hire. Like, Rom-Com Drama Bomb was the first time I hired an external artist with Victor. And that taught me like, oh, having someone else do that is better. Like, I love my art. I think I'm good at it. I think I have a really specific sort of niche in what I draw and stuff, and it's not perfect for everything. But like, the joy of like what you get from giving a brief to somebody else who's really talented in a way you're not is like, Rom-Com Drama Bomb wouldn't be what it is without Victor's villain design. Like, that is, it just wouldn't.
I do think that I've gotten text messages from you where like, look what I did. And look what like Victor did, or look what this artist did for this game I'm working on. And the stuff when you send me like, look what I did, is always excited. The stuff when you send me like, look what this person did, always seems to be like even more excited. You're like, look, yeah. I had them do this and they did this with it. Look at the synthesis. It's crazy.
I love it. I mean, it's the best. It is the best part about kind of, you know, doing this, making games, is like, and I was talking to Nathan from Reckless to talk about this, which will be out in a couple of weeks. And like, getting to pay someone to do the thing they're really good at is sick. And I think we've learned that a lot in like many-sided media, like how good it feels to be able to like pay performers and things like that. And it just rules. So like, I think it's been a slow distillation across these games of like, what are the things that I want and need to focus my energy on, like how can I bring other people into it that are better at things to make this a better overall thing, and like how can I make this into like the best physical product it can be. And I think that like, The Time We Have is such a culmination of those lessons in like, I'm now trying to make a deck of cards, and that's like a whole other production process that like, I don't know, 2 years ago me would have been like, I'm never going to make a deck of cards. I'm a little indie zine designer hobbyist. Even though I've only made one zine.
I will take full credit because yeah, I won't let you make zines anymore.
You won't let me make zines. But that's all the more right. And I mean, yeah, I think that like, this has been a huge lesson for me in the time you and I have worked together, in the time I've been making games. And I think that a lot of our work together and your, you know, both collaboration relationship and friendship has just made me a more confident artist. And like, I think that's been like the biggest.
And my bully.
Lesson. And your bully. But yeah, well, yeah, you gotta have good creative partners who bully you a bit. Like, it's like, I don't know. It's just like I think that I am more confident in my ability to create than I ever have been. And that's pretty cool.
I've been thinking about not only creative work, but like producing things, like making some, like going from idea to fully released thing. And the thing that I've been kind of realizing, I'm still trying to synthesize how to exactly put this into words, is that there do not exist any shortcuts. The road is exactly as long for every single person. What do exist are a ton of off-ramps and detours. And the thing that we can do, like with this podcast, or like when you mentor someone, when you work with someone, is keep them on the road that is the shortest distance between two points. You can't get from A to B any shorter than anyone else, but you can definitely do it in a much more long and circuitous route if you don't know where to go. And like me, like, you know, my recent thing has been like figuring out tax stuff for, you know, Bitcherton and, you know, figuring out how to hire employees. And if I hadn't, like, you know, called the New York help desk, basically, and had some woman to be like, oh, honey, I got you, I would have been doing it for hours. And she was like, no, here, let me do it for you in 10 minutes and show you how to do it. All we can do is just keep people on the straightest line possible.
And so many of those detours are marred with, like, a self-doubt or an imposter syndrome or an insecurity. And so I think, like, you know, you can avoid so many of them if you have you know, if you can build that confidence and if you have people who support it in you. And yeah, I feel like that's been the biggest lesson. It's just like, I don't know. It's a little bit of a, if you build it, they will come sort of vibe of like, I keep making games and people keep buying them. And so I think I must be doing something right. And so I'm going to keep doing that as long as I can, hopefully forever. Yeah, it's great.
I think that's a good transition into the crowdfunding campaign for The Time We Have. So just to break down your last couple of crowdfunding campaigns, Project Echo was on Crowdfunder. Your goal was $2,500. You raised $5,630. So like 150% or 250% of what you were trying to do. Rom-Com Drama Bomb on Kickstarter. Goal was $2,000. Raised just under $6,000. 300% of what you're trying to do. The Time We Have on BackerKit. So you're just mixing up different places where you want to do crowdfunding. Trying them all. And the goal is $15,000, which is noteworthy that it is significantly higher than any of the other projects you've done.
Yeah, it's six times the previous high. Yeah.
Six times the previous high. So my question is, I guess there's a lot of questions here of why do you want to try BackerKit? Why is the goal $15,000? Like, what is necessary in that? And I think the question I'm kind of dancing around is, why do you feel confident now that $15,000 is a goal that is attainable and assured to like make this thing happen?
Oof, I mean, we are.
Is that the right phrasing for that? I know.
Yeah. No. I think it's the real. It's the question. It's the obvious question. I mean, like, it's the blunt question I ask myself of just like, why do I feel like I can actually raise $15,000? And you know, peek behind the curtain for people listening to this on the first, and maybe this will seem hilarious, but we're before launch when we're recording this, and like the answer is, I don't know for sure. You know, like I don't know for sure that I can, but I am taking a big swing, and I think I am putting as much behind that swing as I possibly can. I think that like I learned a lot from Project Echo about. I think Project Echo was a lot about like what are attractive reward levels. I think making the Project Echo bundle was like a really key thing for getting it to the scale that it was on a small goal on a small platform. Rom-Com Drama Bomb was a lot about like, you know, thinking about how do we play with stretch goals and how do I design a better campaign page, because my Project Echo campaign page was fine, but Rom-Com I really made a better campaign page. And then like The Time We Have, I am like, this is the most designed campaign page I've made. And honestly, another little thing to put in there in the middle is that we crowdfunded Bitcherton earlier this year. And obviously I was heavily involved in that. And, you know, it's the idea of like so much of what we've talked about in the last few years of like marketing and crowdfunding and all these things is just like, it's 1,000 little things all contributing this much. And I think that like with Project Echo and Rom-Com, I did about 1,000 things. And with The Time We Have, I have tried to do like 5,000. It's like really the difference is that like I am now full time. I can devote a lot of energy into all of these things. I can devote a lot of energy into, you know, writing and marketing and hiring and, you know, TikTok and all the social medias and all that. And truthfully, I think I just believe in this game in a way that I believed in Rom-Com and Project Echo, but there's a special place in my heart for this game where like I feel like I've put a lot of myself into it, and I'm just like, this is either people are going to vibe with this or they're not. And so far people are vibing with it in early demos and they're really responding to it. When it comes to BackerKit, I just felt like the Kickstarter offering was not as shiny as it maybe used to be, was sort of my feeling when I was deciding on what platform, that like there was a time where Kickstarter could bring in a lot of internal people to the platform. And honestly, with Rom-Com Drama Bomb, when I looked at the analytics at the end, it wasn't a huge percentage of my backers that came from within the platform. And, you know, I talked to the people at BackerKit a lot who had been sort of reaching out to folks about trying the platform. And I got a sense of support, really, truthfully, that like support and knowledge, I think, is like the big thing that I feel from BackerKit. I think that they want to give you all the tools, and they want to tell you the to-do list. And like just yesterday, I got like a long email of like, hey, things are looking great, your project's approved, but here's like 7 or 8 things that we recommend like adding to your marketing pushes and adding to your page. And you just wouldn't get that with Kickstarter, you know, like you'd kind of have to do a little bit of that work yourself. And I understand like there's, you know, some people have tried BackerKit in this season of crowdfunding to good success and to middling success and what have you. But I just feel good about them as a platform. And I think I like what they're doing. And also the marketing, if you do BackerKit marketing, is a little cheaper if you are crowdfunding on BackerKit. So that doesn't hurt either.
They do also have just such a specialization in tabletop and role-playing games that
they do.
That Kickstarter just does. I mean, Kickstarter is mostly about like what's the coolest wallet.
Or it's like a lot, it's inundated with 5e projects when it comes to tabletop. That still feels like so much of what's on Kickstarter.
And I like what you said about like, you know, your first 2 games, you're doing 1,000 things and now you're doing 5,000. And I think that's definitely true, you know, watching you go through this process. And I think we've both been learning this as we go along. Like what we thought were the 1,000 things we had to do were actually about, you know, this is very much the detour straight line idea. It was only about like 500 of those things we actually had to do. The other 500 did not need to be done. And now I think you and us as a company and, you know, stuff that we work on, we're getting better at noticing like what are actually the things we have to do that will actually help us go forward.
100%.
So kind of on that note, you're doing a lot of stuff in this crowdfunding campaign that I think we learned a lot from the Triangle Agency crowdfunding campaign that we loved so much.
Yes.
What do you think are the biggest things you're bringing to this crowdfunding campaign that will help make it a success?
Yeah. Triangle Agency was a huge influence. I feel like I learned so many lessons from talking to them. And a lot of different crowdfunding campaigns have I think been like I've used as reference throughout, but still it's funny that like even it's been a year and a half, 2 years half, since Triangle Agency. I still go back to their Kickstarter page and like reference different things they did because I think the design of it is just so good. Like just visually, it is such a stunning, like easy to read page. So I think like one of the biggest things is like, I want this to be a visually compelling crowdfunding campaign that like, as you scroll through it, you like get what you need to get on every section. I think that one of the things that we talk about a lot, and we wrote kind of a whole newsletter series about this, and then we talked to the Triangle Agency folks about this, is that there was a day when Triangle Agency launched where even though you and I were not aware of it before launch, all of a sudden we were like, this game is everywhere.
It was not only this game is
talking about this game.
It felt like that game had been out for like a year and I just missed it somehow.
Yeah.
It was just so ubiquitous.
Yeah, it's like it was a really cool feeling, and like it really like I think helped carry them in those first few days, in addition to months and months of buildup of work with their, I don't want to, you know, negate the demo they put out and how in advance they were working on that, which I did not take that lesson because I can never seem to do things as early as I'd like to. But in that vein, what I did is I said, hey, I'm an actual play person. I've made a lot of actual play relationships in the last few years. I think I'm just going to send this game to all the people I think are cool and see if they want to make a one shot of it. And like, in a great stroke of luck and betting on me from a lot of people, you know, I had a lot of people really respond to the game and be like, yeah, I really want to make something of this, which is a good feeling. And so in that vein, there are 9 actual plays that are coming out over the course of the campaign, including one that came out a week before, you know, 3-4 the week that this is coming out, 4 on launch week, and then another 4 throughout the rest of the campaign, and maybe a 5th, which it hasn't been confirmed, but might happen. So yeah, it was like it was really kind of surreal to go to all of these people who are peers and friends and have them be really excited to do it. I think that it speaks to the reputation we've built in actual play, and it really spoke to me in like, oh, I've built a reputation as a game designer as well, that like people, you know, respect my work and think that it will be a good experience. And yeah, so I'm hoping for that feeling on those first few days that the game is everywhere that people got with Triangle Agency. And I don't need to hit $350,000 or whatever. I'd be happy to fund.
Right. But also be happy to hit $350,000. Let's be very clear.
I mean, to be very clear, if I hit $350,000, my life would change. But like, yeah.
I also think, the ubiquity of Triangle Agency is a thing that we've talked about a bunch. Like, we'll send each other Kickstarter campaigns that we see for different TTRPGs of just like, look at this. Like, this one's killing it. Why are they killing it? Like, I remember there was that like mech solo game. I think it was called Ion Heart.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That also was just like everywhere, and it had like, you know, gorgeous art, and it funded to the moon. But I was just looking through that, and I was like, what are the things we can learn from this? Like, what are the things we can pull from this? And one of the things, like, you know, I'm just looking through your BackerKit campaign now, is that I can scroll through this really quick, and there's a lot of words I can read. But if I didn't want to read anything, I can tell you exactly what this game is from the art and the layout. And like, I immediately know that care has been taken. And I also know what this game's about just by a quick scroll through, which I think is huge. It's huge because the first time you look through anything, you do the quick glance. And if it passes the quick glance test, great. I'll read a little bit. If that passes, I'll read a little bit more. It's always like one little step further, one little step deeper. And then if you get deep enough, that's when someone actually decides to back it and give you their money.
Do you want to hear a depressing thing that the BackerKit folks told me? Or this is either in their guidance or it's something they told me. Most backers don't read more than the first 10 to 20% of your campaign page.
It's good to know.
Yeah.
It's good to know.
It's like you need to hook them, and you need to hook them quick. And there's a certain kind of person out there who will not go any further. And they'll either decide, yeah, I'm in, or no, I'm moving on.
I think that there's a part of my mind that immediately goes like, that's unfair, or that's like bullshit. Like, come on, just like read a little further. But also, anyone who's listening to this, if you scroll TikTok or any kind of like short form vertical video, you will see something and you decide in the first 0.5 seconds whether or not you're going to say
it. Oh, yeah.
Like, oh, yeah. You judge a book by its cover, and there's a reason that's a saying, because that's how you decide on things. So if your cover's not good, if that first second doesn't hook, I'm going to skip past it probably. It's not fair, but it's a good thing to keep in mind that it's just like, it's the reality. It's how we work.
I agree. Yeah, it's an unfortunate reality. But I mean, like, I got a shout out, like, huge credit. The reason this campaign page looks so good is, one, I put a lot of work into it. But two, I worked with a really good artist. I mean, like, this game's whole visual identity is thanks to Ripley Ash and the, like, beautiful identity that they have created. And this is I want to shout out a lesson that I took from Tyler Crumrine of Possible Worlds Games, in that Tyler has always talked about the value in collaborating with artists outside of TTRPGs, in meeting and collaborating with artists that come from different disciplines. And Ripley is an illustrator that I met at Five Points Fest, which was a festival I did in the spring where I tabled, and I had a very okay weekend, and I was feeling very discouraged about tabling and the fact that like very few people wanted to buy like my art and my games. But that weekend was ultimately so worth it because I met Ripley at that weekend, and we ended up getting coffee over the summer and decided to become collaborators on this. And like, this game just wouldn't look like this without them.
That is a good thing. I don't know. I'm trying to loop this back to this idea of detours. And it's like the thing about the Zen master, you know, we'll see. Because the weekend of that thing, you would have said, oh, this was a waste of time. This was a detour. Zoom out 2 months. You're like, oh, actually, I think that was right on the main path.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And, you know, I'm not a big, like, manifesting kind of person, but I am a big intention person, and we're big intention people. Obviously, we talk about intention a lot. And I think that, like, this year has been a big, I think that my intention has been rewarded at different stages. I think that, like, I really have tried to set an intention to do a certain thing and make it work kind of no matter what. And yeah, that weekend felt like what could be a failure or a misstep. But ultimately, I think that my intention carried me through and like something good came out of it. So yeah, I definitely don't really believe in manifestation, but I do think that like if you're following your intention, like things will come together.
So we've been talking for a while, and honestly, you and I could talk for hours about this game, about crowdfunding, about actual play, all this stuff. And we do. It's our favorite way to procrastinate by pretending that we're doing work because we're talking about the work that we do. But let's actually just turn and get into the nitty-gritty of this campaign. Specifically, you know, who are the collaborators? What are they collaborating on? And also, what rewards can people get if they back this campaign?
Absolutely. So the other kind of piece behind this $15,000 goal is I'm working with more people than I ever have on a campaign. So the core team behind the game is myself, Ripley Ash, who I mentioned, is the illustrator. Samantha Lee, your friend and mine, is the editor. Behold is done a theme song, which people can listen to right now. And then B. Marsolier of Planet Arcana, of A Fool's Errand, designed the incredible, incredible logo, which I love. But wait, there's more. There are 18 guest contributors coming onto this project to make door cards. And what are door cards? Door cards are very akin to queen cards and For the Queen, in that they will be ways that you can define the zombie apocalypse you're playing within. They will have a short piece of fiction on one side and a corresponding illustration on the other. In that vein, we have the following guest writers: Harlan Guthrie, Caleb Zane Hewitt, Jay Stroutman, Kendrick Smith, Kyle Tam, Viditya Valetti, Caro Assertion, Taylor Navarro, Dylan Apelian. And we have the following guest illustrators: Raul Vopato, Victor Winter, John Gagne, Sonia Henar, Justin McElroy, no relation, Connor Nolan, Wes Cahal, Evangeline Gallagher, and Nadir Noor.
That is two murderer's rows of
two absolute of murderer's rows. Yeah, it's a great mix of friends and people whose work I have been a fan of for a long time, and people whose work I've discovered in the process of looking for collaborators on this. Some of these illustrators, like, their work has just like blown my mind when I found them. So yeah, those folks are going to get together and make these door cards. And so that's a lot of people. And I'm forgetting what the other part of this question I was supposed to answer was.
Oh, what can people get rewards?
Ah, yes. In terms of rewards, we have a few different pledge levels. The PDF of the game, which will include a guide for playing with just a standard deck of playing cards, kind of a little look back to the original thought on this game, is $20. The physical copy of the game, which comes in a nice rigid box in 80 tarot-sized card deck, is $40. You can bundle those together for $50. You can get two physical copies in a very cute pledge called Four Brothers for $60. And then what I'm very excited about is we have a couple special edition pledge levels at $80, or if you want a signed special edition and you want to throw more money at the project to support, there's a signed special edition for $150. And the special edition is essentially going to be, how can I make this game into a beautiful art piece that you want to put on your shelf in addition to a game that you want to play? It will have a very minimalist silver foil cover. I've been talking to Ripley about maybe designing a full new alternate cover. So that's going to be really beautiful. It's going to be a magnetic book box. It'll just be a really nice feeling game. The base game is going to feel nice too. Don't worry. I insist on making a nice feeling game, but the special edition is really like the, you turn that front facing on your bookshelf instead of tucking it in with your other games. And then there's a final $500 tier if you would like to play the game with me, which is, I don't know. Maybe people want to pay that to play the game with me. I don't know. We'll see. And it's running till the 27th.
Yeah. Yeah. What are the dates this is going to be running? It's
so as of time of release, it has been going for a couple days, and we will be running until Wednesday, November 27th at, I believe, 9 p.m. Eastern, right until Thanksgiving.
Right up until Thanksgiving. And then you can go and kick your brother's ass while trying to steal the mashed potatoes. Well, hopefully, as people are listening to this, hopefully it is already funded and beyond its funding. So we won't worry any more about this game. We'll let people check it out for themselves and learn more and really dig into this game. Is there's a free PDF trial version available, right?
There is a demo. There's a print and play demo linked right on the Backer Kit page.
Hell yeah. So check it out. Really go support this game. But we do want to pivot over to the way we end all of these conversations is, what are you bringing to the table? So Ellie, why don't you tell us something that you're bringing to the table? You know, this could be in tabletop, outside of tabletop. You know the game.
Today, I would love to bring a fellow crowdfunding campaign by some dear, dear friends of ours, A Fool's Errand, which is a tarot-fueled science fantasy RPG that is on Kickstarter right now. I'm also a guest writer on that project. I'm going to be writing a big oops, which is the version of an apocalypse, a calamity that you use to kind of kick off your campaign in that game. And so I really love what J&B have made with this game. Like, the tarot deck mechanic is very fun to play with. We've had the opportunity to playtest it. So check out A Fool's Errand on Kickstarter.
Hell yeah. We'll put that link in the show notes below. And you've probably heard us talk about it on this show and elsewhere. Elliot, thank you so much for coming to the table.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. It's not a gun or a strange bomb strapped to me. No way. Rather than telling people where they can find you online, can you give us one last final pitch for The Time We Have?
The Time We Have is going to be the singular sad TTRPG experience of your year if you play it. That's the best pitch I can give. And you can find it at sadzombiegame.com.
That sounds like something you want to check out. Go to sadzombiegame.com right now and back the project. I think we've also learned about crowdfunding campaigns. Getting those early backers is incredibly important. So if you're thinking about doing it, if you want to do it, don't wait till later. Do it right now.
Thanks, love you.
And if you want more gaming content from us, you can check out the 20-sided newsletter and the many-sided media Discord. Both of those will be linked in our show notes below. We'll likely be talking about The Time We Have a whole bunch in both those places in the coming weeks. Please rate, review, and follow Talk at the Table wherever you get your podcasts. And that's what The Table is talking about. Bye, everybody.
Wait, no, tell them how I'm a world-renowned lover.
I'm not saying it.